I know.
By so quickly. Alrighty. So we are going to finish up the semester today with a piece from Martha Nussbaum. Martha Nussbaum is a very famous moral philosopher. She's got an appointment at the University of Chicago now in the Department of Comp Lit. And she does a lot of writing at the intersection of literature and philosophy. But she's also quite a public intellectual, and she's written some pieces recently that are very much about topics that are in the public dialogue. So she wrote a book on disgust and what its relationship is to the slow evolution of LGBT rights. So that was her latest book. And she's written on a lot of political things as well. But this is a piece that came out, let's see, do I have the date on Therapy of Desire? No. This is a book called Therapy of Desire. And her view is that philosophy is a kind of therapy, is a kind of solve for certain types of human problems, largely existential, but not just. She's engaging in this piece with all of our friends, with Lucretius. We talked about him last time, with Nagel, as you know. We're encountering, thank you, Bernard Williams for the first time. He wrote the piece called The Macropolis Case that you had. And he's a very famous, he died a few years ago, but he was a very famous 20th century philosopher, and it's kind of an interesting anecdote. I was at Harvard right around the time that Martha Nussbaum's, a little bit after Martha Nussbaum's very famous first book came out, which was called Fragility of Goodness. And she had been a student of Bernard Williams, and he had written a book, a very small book. She had written this tome. Fragility of Goodness is such a big fat book that its typeset looks like it's about 8 point. It's one of those tricks that you tell students to never, ever do, to try to make it look like it's really not that big by just making the type practically microscopic. So she wrote this tome called Fragility of Goodness. Right after, or not long after, he wrote a very, very small book called Moral Luck. And his closest friend is a guy named Jeffrey Hawthorne, and he was visiting at Harvard the semester that I started at Harvard. And he's told the story that Bernard Williams really believes that Fragility of Goodness was just a ripoff of Moral Luck, but Moral Luck's really small and Fragility of Goodness is really big. So things got fairly tense between Bernard and Martha after that. But it does seem to have the same kind of shtick, and that is the idea that your the moral commitments can fall apart, or circumstances can be such that you can't live up to your moral code if certain tragic circumstances get in your way, and that is a kind of moral luck that prevents you, and that's why it's called Fragility of Goodness, because goodness is only robust so far, but certain life events can actually undermine that. At any rate, this is the next book, Therapy of Desire, her second book. And in it, she's taking a lot of that was very much a Greek playwright and ancient Greek philosopher text, the Fragility of Goodness. So it was Plato and Aristotle and all of the playwrights. Therapy of Desire are the folks who come afterwards, so it's not surprising that she's actually writing about Lucretius. And what she's trying to do in this piece is to show, as everyone is trying to do, that Lucretius is wrong. But to do it, she's going to have to knock off Nagel and Williams on the way, because they also are trying to argue that Lucretius is wrong. So that's the basic structure of this piece. So let's start. Let's start with the quote that's at the top from Heraclitus. Heraclitus is a pre-Socratic thinker. He's writing 200 years or so before Plato is writing. And we only have his words, his text, in fragments that have surfaced in the work of those who were in the Socratic period, so Plato and Aristotle and the playwrights at that time. But he was a very, supposedly, one of the first philosophers of this lineage, and very famous for the view that everything is in flux and everything is always changing. And he was famous for sort of having this notion of flux and change in his finger. But anyway, he writes this, and I thought we'll start with this to kick it off. Mortals immortal. Immortals. Mortal. It's already getting hard. Alive with respect to mortal's death. Dead with respect. To their life. It's actually a perfect quotation for Martha Nussbaum to use to frame this argument. So let's start by figuring out what Heraclitus could possibly be saying. And some of it, she actually does quite a bit of parsing as you go through this 30-page paper. She explains quite a bit of this, but I think getting that out in front is helpful to us as a nice frame for what she's going to argue. Philosophers never care much if the punchline comes first. It's not a whodunit, so let's see what we can do with this. What do you have there? Is there any piece of that that you get? What do you think? Silence. Nussbaum's not that hard. Heraclitus is kind of tricky in this piece. Okay, Jonna?
I guess what I'm getting from it is that mortality and immortality define each other, and one can't really exist without the other.
Okay, now let's focus concretely. Oops, maybe it would help if I actually spelled this right. Okay, I said morals because I'm kind of a moral philosopher and don't really care about death, I guess, but that word is mortal. Mortals, immortal. Immortals, mortal. Let's start with this back end, or even just understanding who these folks are. Who are the mortals and who are the immortals, if Heraclitus is the one that's writing this? So it's not us, Heraclitus. And he's writing when? 500 BCE, at a time when people in Greece thought what?
Gods.
That there were gods, mm-hmm. Right. And what is true about the Greek gods? What do you know about them? What do we know? Anything?
A large number of them.
There's a large number of them, right? So they're not just one god.
They represent various...
Highly specialized.
Yeah, they're exactly. Specialized. They have certain kinds of strengths. Okay?
They were, in a sense, mortal. I mean, they were immortal, but they also could be killed.
Okay. I didn't think most of them could be killed. They could be hurt. Can they be killed?
I thought they could be killed.
They can be killed?
Yeah, Zeus's father.
The gods killed the titans.
Yeah, all right, so there you go. The one she's talking about, though, that doesn't make sense. She's certainly she's trying to talk about the immortal gods. But all right, tell me what else we know about those gods. What were they like?
They're very mortals.
Yes, they were not great. They were certainly not pure of heart. They were not moral exemplars. And what about the way that they lived their lives? I mean, they weren't really that nice, that is true. What else was their kind of character? How would you describe them? You know, you think about...
Vindictive.
Yeah, they could have revenge, right? That was one of their more serious kind of emotions.
Hedonistic.
They were right, exactly. They lived in the moment, they lived for pleasure. They were actually quite light-minded. They were not serious. They were playful and they actually toyed with others. So they have this... Right. Okay, and that's going to be a big punchline now. All right. So, given what we know about them, the gods are the immortals. And they're, in a way, mortal. Maybe it's the literal sense in which you mean it. But I think that Heraclitus is really concerned more about literal mortality. And in what sense are the immortals mortal in a human sense? In what sense, in relationship to humans, what would you say? Because this is what the second half. They are alive with respect to the mortal's death. In other words, what do we know about them?
Wait, is that second one there, mortals or moral?
Alive with respect to...
Yeah. No wonder you're all so confused. Alive with respect to mortal's death. So they do not experience the death that we experience. That's why they're alive to it. That's fine. But why are they dead with respect to our life? Why are the immortals dead with respect to the mortal's life? In what sense can they be understood?
They cannot see them. The alive people cannot see them.
No, these are the immortals. Why are the immortals dead when it comes to human life?
Disregard.
They disregard maybe, but more deeper than that.
I think it's because meaning in life comes from the fact that you don't live forever.
And yes.
There is a finite existence, and that's what gives it so much. So that's what makes it so special and unique. And that immortals, because they live forever, begin to miss out on that mortality.
In fact, they can't access it at all.
Right.
Because they can't access our mortality, they can't access our life. It's dead to them. It's blocked from them. There's something, Heraclitus thinks, even that long ago, that makes human life special, unique, and even very meaningful because of its mortality. And the immortals don't have any access to that meaning. They are trivial and light-minded and frivolous as a group. They are not a group worth emulating or respecting. Maybe you have to respect them out of fear, but you don't respect them because you admire them and you admire who they've become. They don't have that kind of character or virtue, and that's going to be the frame for Nussbaum, because when we get to the end of this, she's going to argue that mortality gives us a whole bunch of stuff in addition to tragedy and loss, but it gives us a whole bunch of the positives that actually make life meaningful, and that is completely inaccessible, dead to the immortals. They can't access all of this. They can't access any of that. So that's why the immortals are actually mortal, because they are dead in a very important way. In every way we consider powerful and meaningful, if you have immortality, you can't access it. So you have your own kind of death when you're immortal. Not if you've lived a mortal life and then you get immortality. This is not a Christian conception. If you get one and then you get the other, that's like your cake and eat it too. This is, you're either one or the other, and if you got the fate, you rolled the dice that you're immortal, you don't have any access to the richness of what it means to be mortal. That's what Heraclitus is arguing. What about that mortals can be immortal? How is that true? How can the mortals, that's us, be immortal?
By the Lord. Behind.
Exactly, and there's lots of them. And so by the time we get to the end of class, one of the things we're going to try to think about is what are the ways that those who are dying, which is all of us, sooner or later, but certainly the closer it comes, what is it that we do to access a kind of immortality when bodily, physical immortality is not good and is not accessible to us? And how do we access that in a way that is not vulnerable to Cass's claim of hubris among those who are trying every and any mechanism to prolong their life? This is a kind of charge that we started the beginning of the semester with, when Leon Cass basically argued that those people who just and the loved ones who make these sometimes decisions for patients who just, even when there's absolutely no hope, use expensive therapies and try everything and refuse nothing, that's a kind of hubris, as if we haven't recognized our state of mortality. And so Cass has a condemnation for that behavior. But Nussbaum is arguing there is a type of accessing or reaching for immortality that actually makes life very rich and does not have anything to do with hubris. And as we end class today, we're going to want to think about what that is. So yes, that's the frame for this. Okay, how about this Nicodion? Anybody do some homework here to figure out who Nicodion is? Because I don't think Martha tells us here. She just starts with Nicodion, as if you're supposed to know. It could be, though, I haven't read the other five chapters that come before this for, you know, a decade. So it could be that she gets Nicodion. She probably doesn't introduce Nicodion pretty early, because she likes to do that kind of thing. So she's got a kind of personification, somebody, some actual person that can weave through, you know, whatever particular philosophical treatise she's talking about. But Nicodion isn't somebody that Martha Nussbaum made up, though somebody did. Anybody look it up? Nicodion is thought to be the student of Lucretius, a devoted Epicurean, who is struggling. Oh, and Martha Nussbaum often takes women as lead characters, especially in the extraordinarily misogynistic, male-centered culture of ancient Greek philosophy. She's an ancient Greek philosopher, and so she redeems some of that misogyny by having a focus in a lot of her work on female characters, however fictional, like Antigone and Nicodion. So this is a student, supposedly a fictional student, of Lucretius, an Epicurean, and it's a 3rd century Hellenistic philosopher named Diogenes Laertius who is the person who refers to Nicodion as a possible student or someone who might have been a student of Lucretius. So she's got Nicodion for the purpose of what? Why have Nicodion open up a piece like this? Hopefully we've got some people who read it, because otherwise it doesn't matter. I'm going to read a lot of the passages, but that first question will not be accessible unless you did. Why, or at least unless you read last week's, why would Nicodion be the right person to be the foil in this paper? We're all digesting that pizza. Just kind of like lulling here. All right, I'll tell you what I think. I think that Nicodion is chosen because Lucretius has presented quite a challenge to us. He's claimed that we ought not to fear death. We talked about that last week. And he argues that we are condemnable and culpable if we do fear death, because he's argued that death is not problematic because the non-existence of it means that there is actually nothing to have go badly for you once you are dead. So you've just made a mistake in thinking that there's something wrong, something evil about death. Now the problem, of course, is that nobody believes that, and least of all Nicodion. Though she's trying to struggle to understand the master's great wisdom here, she's not really all on board. And so the foil here is Nicodion, who's not automatically opposed to Lucretius, in fact, is predisposed to worship and try to adopt the profound teachings of the master. Why have a student of Lucretius in that role in this paper that's going to attack Lucretius? Why would you do that?
To ask the questions to expose the conflict or the weakness in the logic.
All right, so students often do ask questions, but couldn't you have an enemy of Lucretius ask those questions?
But an enemy would be somebody who would be considered to be malevolent, where this being a student who presumably admires and respects, for them to expose the flaws is much more telling and I think more convincing.
All right, and also gives the benefit of the doubt wherever the benefit of the doubt could be given. If you start with somebody who's predisposed to like your argument, and you can't convince that person, then you really have had a tough climb, because that person wants to agree with you, but just simply can't. That's different than the person who's trying to pick it apart right from the beginning and tear it to shreds, because they're already predisposed to not like your argument. And so it doesn't take that much to start ripping something apart before you've understood it. Whereas if in the end Nicodion doesn't believe Lucretius, we can be assured that she tried her best to actually adopt the view or understand the view before she did that. So it's really quite a clever mechanism to have us understand that Nussbaum isn't going to just get up there and shred Lucretius, though she pretty much does, but having this device gives us the benefit of the doubt that we're actually working with it. Though I must say, she's not very generous when she gets to Nagel, though she thinks she is, but partly because she needs to get enough distance from Nagel that she can say that what she's saying is really very new and very much an addition. But all right, very good. So that is why we are using this foil here. All righty, let's read this passage here. That kicks us off this existential pain that we have in facing death. And I'm going to read this passage as it starts with Nicodion.
First page.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the first page.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm in the second paragraph. And the question is, Nicodion might be concerned that Epicurus and Lucretius didn't get it right. For Nicodion might, as often happens, take a walk at dawn in the early spring. She might feel the knife-like beauty of the morning, See leaves half unrolled, translucent, their sharp green still touched by life. The sun striking sparkles on the moving surface of a stream. And she would listen then, in the silence, to the sweet and deadly music of time. Images summoned by the smell of new spring air might spin before her then, crowding and overlapping. Images of faces loved and mourned, of childhood and home, of play and hope and new desire. She would see that morning through the images until each tree looked not only like itself but like many things that are gone, and each of her steps was taken in company with the dead. The beauty of things would appear to her under the aspect of mourning and become for this reason the more beautiful and lordly, the more human, the more terrible. She walks in time, exile from a thousand times, transient on the way to no time at all. No animal could see so beautiful a morning. Tell me what this is that Nicodian is experiencing here in this passage. Why does Nussbaum take two paragraphs? Philosophers always cut to the chase. Obviously, she's not. Because she's trying to do what with this passage that she's entirely made up? I think Nussbaum wishes she were a novelist, so this is sort of short of that. What is she getting at? What is this feeling? What are we getting at? What's she trying to invoke here with all of that?
Things are always dying. Like, things are always dying. They're always in a state of flux.
All right, so it's a nice way to tie back to the Heraclitus moment, that everything is changing, everything's in flux. But everything is changing, and that is true. But now give me the stakes of that, because, of course, everything could be changing, but so what? Like, for example, today we had really big rain, and then we had sun, and now it's going to rain again. Everything's always changing with the weather. And yet it doesn't feel like there's any oomph to that statement. That's clearly not where we are. Doesn't matter. We'll get everybody. Just go around.
Just the sort of ambivalence that is to the beauty that develops is also the death at the same time.
Okay. So just as it's unfolding, it already has its seeds of its own demise. The leaf comes and it ends.
Recognition of one's own mortality is what adds flavor and gratitude to life.
All right. And a kind of longing and a kind of sadness in this passage as well. Emily?
Oh, that's kind of what I was going to say, just that she found beauty in the morning.
All right, so there is beauty in this moment, but the beauty is fleeting. This whole thing that she's experienced, every bit of this is fleeting.
And that's a uniquely human capability.
Right, that what she's arguing here at the last sentence is, you can't be an animal, at least as we understand animal minds, which we don't understand that well, and actually appreciate something like beauty. And that is often said. Philosophers often talk about beauty as being one of the central features of human appreciation, like morality. Okay? Are you not?
It's covered.
Alrighty. Yeah, okay. So the idea here is not being able to hold on to this moment and that as symbolic for so many moments. Like what? What else? She uses beauty. What else can you tap into that would get you the same place? What else? What other experiences, images, events could get you that exact same place in terms of human finitude and all that surrounds it and the, you know, the fact that it's poignant in that moment? Like what? What else would it, because what she's trying to do is get you to be Nicodian in that moment and feel that feeling. All that stuff you've just said about longing and finitude and the end and death and birth and all of that. What else could give you that?
Really, any life-changing experience that you adopt something new or you take on a new role. But you also abandon what you had before.
Yeah, but now, and give it to me now in a moment, because what she wants is, and you're right, now she wants you to, that sense that it, you can't hold on to this, that something you have, you can't hold on to, something that is so valuable, it's fleeting. What are the other moments in human life where you get a feeling like that? One is, okay, spring morning walk. What else?
Listen to music.
Okay, all right.
Birth of a child.
Yeah, infant, child, right, exactly. Any discrete moment in childhood, looking at an infant, graduation from preschool, whatever. You know, there are all of these moments where you think that's a moment you can never get back. Whereas in adulthood, it's a little bit harder to tell because things seem like they go on in prime adulthood for quite a long time, and you don't sort of notice the subtle changes like you do with children. Okay, what else?
You could have dramatic social events like war or things like that where you think that's a moment after which I'll never be the same again.
Okay, all right.
A natural disaster like an earthquake.
Okay, can make people feel like there was something that was so much fragility and you know, flux and fate and, all right. Okay, so all of that helps us understand that finitude, this is why she does this, finitude and our impending, looming mortality, which is sooner or later, but there in human life, built into the cards, already there. That does set up for us a fear of death, if not the dying, of the actual ending of all of this. And that's the whole point of that. It's that you don't want it to end. Just if the infancy of that child was going to turn into you watching 15 generations of more and more and more and more children, that finitude wouldn't be bothersome, wouldn't be problematic. So this is all a setup to say that Lucretius doesn't seem to quite have it right, and now we're trying to figure out why not. Now, to give him, though, to give Lucretius some credence here, because, you know, we're still reading him, and he's really, really, really old, so we have to think about, well, what are the problems that this fear of death brings? I think she wants to acknowledge that he's not wrong, that it's got some costs. In the end, she's going to argue, as we know, that finitude and mortality brings us something, just as it costs the gods something to not have it. So first, though, she wants to acknowledge that Lucretius wasn't off his rocker. He wasn't nuts. He had some good reasons for why this fear of death can actually be very undermining. And he lists four things, and they are on, for her, on page 196 to 198. Alrighty. The first one is that having a fear of death brings us a kind of subservience to religion. And that's on page 197. And she quotes Lucretius, but then she gives her own commentary right after that indented passage. Religious belief is bad, Lucretius persistently argues, because it is superstitious and irrational, built upon false and groundless beliefs about gods and the soul. It's also bad because it makes people dependent on priests rather than on their own judgment, and priests stimulate human fears, further increasing dependence. But it's bad above all because it causes people to harm one another, committing criminal and impious deeds. For example, Agamemnon's slaughter of his own child in the service of the gods. Okay, what do you think of the relationship between religion and fear of death? Lucretius isn't painting a very good picture. He's arguing that there's a kind of subservience to it. Because humans fear death, they've got a subservience to religion, and that subservience plays out in having a negative impact on the way people live their lives. What do you think of that?
Bill Maher would like that.
Yeah, I kind of do.
All right. You like that?
Yeah.
Now let's be Nicodian as the student of Lucretius and redeem it a little bit. Is that glib? Is it too quick?
I mean, there are lots of people for whom religion brings the greatest happiness and who don't experience for themselves the harms that it does.
Like, okay.
They weren't part of the Crusades, for example.
Okay.
They don't see
right.
That.
Right. Okay. Like what? Like, what kind of thing can people get from religion?
I also think, people who are religious or certain religions, like, I don't think that necessarily means that there is a fear of death. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost comforting. Like, death isn't as scary because you believe that it's not necessarily finite.
Okay. And how would that make your life better?
I think that then you're not as preoccupied, like, as someone who is worried about dying.
Okay.
Necessarily. It might... All right.
Okay. So at least the negative
energy of right. worry and anxiety that most of us can, you know, really churn up, and almost as paralyzing, stopping one in one's tracks. If you have a view that it's all going to be okay, you don't have to just sit and stew and get depressed and anxious and waste time, because you can actually turn that into the regular projects and plans that you would have already been doing. All right, what else?
Salvaging religion here. So let's have about people who are not really thinking about religion for about immortality. Not, oh, well, I'm religious because I know that I've got the guaranteed afterlife. There's plenty of religion and plenty of religious people. Don't think that there's much going on after you're dead. And still find religion to not be, you know, the opiate of the people thing that Lucretius, you know, 2,000 years before Marx, but is still grooving on.
Well, there's a difference between religion and spirituality.
Okay, maybe not, though.
So
if you focus on spirituality instead of religion, what can you get for us?
Well, and I was going to say also that fear of death and religion, sort of numbing that fear of death, is only a very small part of religion. And so there's other aspects of religion, you know, peace or calm, or sort of a calming of the mind, community, culture, things that have very little to do with your ultimate demise that are considered important parts of religion as well. So.
Okay.
It would be incomplete to simply say that everyone is focused on religion as simply as a way to take away their fear of death, because
right.
there's so much more than that. For
all right. In fact, if Lucretius is upset because the fear of death propels people into a subservience of religion that has them live in a way that's consuming with trying to serve the priests and serve the gods or whatever it is, he's missing the part of religion that actually amplifies parts of life that are to be celebrated and not to be missed and not to be overlooked. The kind of thing that religion does to have people slow down at certain times of the year and take stock, or that celebrate key moments in human life like birth or certain kinds of transitions, that actually is very, one might say, life-affirming. Rather than life undermining.
I also think he's using like subservience as such a negative connotation, whereas like the group of people that he's talking about maybe don't feel like it's subservience, maybe they feel like it's devotion,
mm-hmm.
or something with a positive connotation.
Mm-hmm.
So
or passion or calling or vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Also, some people could see it as a sense of giving like meaning rather than the nihilistic, or just a random event, a chemical event.
Right, so it could be that instead of it being the denial of the meaning and value of life, religion can actually be that which makes it important, because it has a larger trajectory and purpose and intention, rather than some big bang and good luck and I don't know how we got here and, you know, the existential crisis the non-religious actually have that can actually make them very paralyzed. All right, great. What about this second concern he has, which is about a low-level dissatisfaction, never feeling like you're getting enough, and this because of the fear of death, right after that. Second, the fear of death interferes with the enjoyment of such pleasures as mortal human life does offer. We've already seen that Epicurus believes we must banish this fear in order to make the mortality of life enjoyable, and Lucretius has claimed that the fear interferes with life from its foundation on up, leaving no pleasure undisturbed. He shows us, too, people who never find satisfaction in any activity, since no activity succeeds in gratifying their thirst for immortal existence. Can you tap into that? People who never find satisfaction in anything, because nothing actually overcomes the problem of mortality. Does that resonate? So you think about people who never seem to be satisfied with anything. We can get that. And is the reason because they will ultimately be dead? Can you give me a way to get that linked? If you're Nicodian, you got to work a little hard here. And if not, people who have this low-level satisfaction and never seem to be satisfied, just a malaise, a kind of dissatisfaction. What explains that? If not, that they don't want to live because they can't overcome mortality. What do we have here? Do you have anybody in mind? You don't have to name any names.
I have a fictional character in mind.
All right, how wacky. I don't want to hear like Batman.
No, it's just some guy in a book I read called Dolorous Ed.
And what did Bill say?
He was just always disappointed because he knew he was going to die pretty soon anyway.
Well, how soon?
He was on a little march, and he was pretty sure that he was going to die on the march or somehow. So he was never really bright about any prospects or...
Okay. On his march?
Yeah.
All right, how about if we don't go to Dolores'
I think you can apply it to, it's a generalized statement, but the aging population. I think those, read a little bit further on, you get down to Williams, and talking about people just wasting away in the nursing home.
Oh, okay.
Just completely, just, there's nothing left to live for.
Okay.
They can't find pleasure in even the smallest.
All right. Okay. Now, when we think about those folks, that category of individuals where they're sort of like, what's the use? It's all winding down anyway. One of the things we would want to ask is there any other confounding variable like, I can't actually go bowling anymore. I can't live independently. I've lost all the people I really care about. Nobody comes to visit me. My mental faculties aren't what they used to be. I can't get a job. In other words, and I don't know, because so one of the things I'm asking about Lucretius is, if we are correctly identifying a group of people that might have this low-level satisfaction, is it that if their bodies were working perfectly well and they were able to do the kind of meaningful projects they had been prior to being in a nursing home and prior to being in the state, would they have felt that way? So that I wonder which is the variable. Is it that death is looming, or is it that life, the life activities that gave their life meaning aren't accessible anymore?
Well, Hargrave talks about that, where he talks about his aunts in the nursing home, and said that basically says, can they have to ask themselves, can I make my life worth living? And it seems like here, this low-level malaise, dissatisfaction, is basically people who may as well die because they can't make their life worth living.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know where to start.
Yeah. I am not sure if I get it out of the tangency, but I was thinking about Raymond Crusoe, the futurist, that he wants to... He wrote this singularity, mm-hmm. where they said, we are getting to the point that we can overcome the limits of biology and live forever.
Well, we're going to talk about that when we talk about Williams and see if we like that, okay?
Not to sound not sensitive to these people, but like anyone who's seriously depressed,
okay.
It's so not any kind of physical,
okay,
problem that is preventing them from...
All right.
Driving.
All right, so it's not that we can't access people who have a low-level satisfaction. What we're trying to access is it because they feel like death is looming? And your case seems to point to some individuals who might feel that way.
I was just going to mention a case that doesn't lead to the issue of death so much, but I think that low-level dissatisfaction kind of explains the artistic sensibility, where writers, painters, etc., are never satisfied, or only satisfied maybe in the first few minutes of completing a project, and then they're never really as good as...
So there's plenty of low-level satisfaction that actually isn't about death being looming. Okay. All right.
I was just thinking about people facing the death penalty and who are sitting on death row. Their death is looming, but the kind of the attention that's paid to them is different, maybe because of their the activities they might do. Suicide, for example. They're under additional observation because of that fact that they're on death penalty, on death row, and could potentially be suicidal. And I think that
we don't find this slightly ironic that we're trying to keep people on death row from killing themselves. Okay, I didn't know that.
The only person I can think of is like Richard Lewis, the comedian.
Yeah. There's some
right,
people.
An example of somebody who literally just feels like, oh, what's the point? We're all dying.
We're all right.
But
okay.
The average person is just not. There aren't people out there like that that don't have some sort of physical or
confounding variable.
Confounder.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, all right.
Richard Corey.
What'd you say?
Richard Corey.
Help us.
In the poem Richard Corey by Edward Robinson, who owned the business in town and ate at the finest restaurants and dressed in the finest clothing and went home last night and put a bullet in his head. It's written from the perspective of somebody who actually worked in his factory.
Is that because, and why did he kill himself?
He killed himself because he had nothing to live for.
He just, all it was wealth. I think we're going to get to that in number four. So let me get to this third, and then the fourth one will be with people who get so much. Okay, let's look at the number three, which is folks who have a frenetic and a restless pace of life. Aimless, restless, frenetic activity that has no point at all other than the avoidance of one's own self and one's own finite condition. They hardly lead their lives as we now often see them do, ignorant of what they really want, always seeking a change of place as if they could put down their burden. Here's a man who often goes outside leaving his house because he's tired of being home, but just as suddenly he turns back since he's feeling no better outdoors, blah, blah, blah. So these are people who are restless and they can't settle in on an activity. And this is because of human mortality. Tell me some of those people. We have those? Go ahead.
Look, me, like I can't, absolutely. Sorry, I don't know why. It speaks to me. I'm terrified.
It does?
Yeah.
So you have to just like maximize. Yes, so you just gotta maximize every minute
possible.
Okay.
Yes, and I think about it. Yeah.
All right, because it's like time's ticking.
Time's wasted.
Time's ticking. Yes. So we've got to maximize it.
Yes.
Okay. Now he wants to say that there's something problematic of that because he thinks that the freneticness of it means that people don't settle down into any particular pursuit. Well, no, that cannot be true of anybody who just trained for an Ironman, Chelsea, so, right?
Keep going, but it's like, so what's next, and what's next?
I know, but
like,
what
you
we
have
do
want... purpose, though.
Right, that's the thing. It's like, see, that's why we have to question the philosophers. There are people who might live at a pace, just like people talk really fast because they've got to make sure that everything they want to say can be said before they die, and they might not have a lot of time, so they just got to get everything in like that. Right? That's why people have to slow down the recordings of this class. Otherwise, it's like Minnie Mouse talking, and I get that. But I don't know that that problem is vulnerable to that charge because that charge is supposed to be someone who can't settle in long enough to actually complete a class or do an Ironman or finish a movie or write a novel or have a child or right exactly. Because if all we're talking about are people who say, I got this block of time and by God I'm gonna squeeze as much into it as possible. I'm gonna get all the meaning and all the projects in. I'm not sure why it would be vulnerable to that attack. All right, what's wrong with that? Only if you're not enjoying what you're doing, if you're doing it for some other purpose, if it's not giving you any kind of meaning, if it's not adding up to something that you like. But if it's that, well, look, I loved being a doctor, but now I feel like, you know what, I'd like to try being a lawyer for a while. Oh, I was a lawyer for a while and I loved it. It was really great. But now I just think I want to be an artist or whatever. Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, people are allowed to live their lives deciding, do they want one project that spans the whole time? Do they want to do 15? I don't think that's really as vulnerable to the frenetic charge unless the frenetic restless means you're never satisfied with any of the projects and they never gave you meaning. That's not the same thing as saying, you know what? I've done that. And now I'd like to try something else. Like I taught yoga for 3 years and now I said, you know what? I'm going to give yoga a break. I don't think that means I'm actually restless and frenetic and I can't settle in to do it, Changing your mind's okay, right? We got to challenge what the philosophers say.
But a bucket list would fit it, where you're just going down checking off things to say, yeah, I've done them.
That's true, and that would mean that they never gave you any meaning. I did all that yoga posing. I'm in downward dog, God knows how many weekends. I never got anything out of that downward dog, but I can check off yoga teacher. Well, okay, if that was what it was like, you have a problem, and you're vulnerable to this. If it's, I was an aerobics teacher for 10 years, then I tried yoga for 3, now I'm doing, well, all right,
But isn't that a limit to determine what is mentally stable and a little...
Yeah, well, she wasn't that stable. I mean, that's the whole point. No kidding. Well, I don't know. I mean, mental stable, what does that mean? I mean, it depends. If you feel like, if you can make any kind of claim that there's something that's missing in any of those activities, like you're doing it for the wrong reason. You're doing it to please someone else, for example. Well, then, maybe. But if it's, I've got 5 different interests. I want to be a doctor, but I also want to be a poet. And so I'm going to do this for a while, but then I'm going to take a sabbatical and I'm going to write poetry for a year. I don't think anybody would look at that and say, oh, that's some instability there. Really? Why? So I don't, right. Alrighty, anyway, we get all those 4 together. The last one I forgot to read, which is that that you're trying to insulate yourself, protect yourself from death by accumulating all the wealth you can, as if money could buy you out of the finitude of human life. What do you think of that? You seen that? Well, everybody talked at once. I was like,
somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody wants to be frozen. You know, somebody wealthy some people can pay to frost their bodies.
All right, so let me see if that applies, because it's true. Sometimes people amass wealth so that they can buy the best health care. And if the best health care is to be frozen at this particular moment, then that's part of that, well, you know what, I got this money so that I could protect myself to get the very best care. Is that what he's talking about when he talks about the amassing of wealth as if you can be invincible with wealth? Because I don't think it really is. That's actually a kind of prudential reasoning, saying, you know what, I want to make enough money so that I can get a very good kind of health insurance so that if there's a new drug on the market, chemotherapy drug, and it costs $100,000 a year, by God, I can get it even if my insurance won't pay, isn't really the same thing as saying, as long as I just keep building money and nothing can happen to me.
That's like the idea that, you know, money can't buy happiness.
Yeah, that's what he's attacking.
People are basically saying, I will just make as much money as possible, and I will have everything I could ever want.
Right.
But they don't find they don't derive any actual pleasure from what they've.
That is definitely the category.
I was going to say it's Scrooge, right? Because he's a miserable.
Mm-hmm.
So.
The one who dies with the most toys wins, kind of.
Right,
right.
Right.
You can't take it with you.
There you go. Yeah, all right, so there probably are those, and you can see why. If that's the reason that you're doing it, then the fear of death is actually having a negative impact. And that was the point of all those, that if fear of death is having these kind of impacts on your life, then Nussbaum will agree with Lucretius, it's got a negative sequelae or consequence, but she wants to argue there's a whole other story. All right, so then she goes through Nagel and his argument. And she talks about the conundrum, the debate we had with the room half split between the two positions last time about what was the problem with for Nagel about death and why it was properly to be feared. And she phrases it or captures this claim of Nagel's that it's because the possibilities of your life have been thwarted. That's her rendition, that there were all of these possibilities that you had in store and you were thwarted from them. And she wants to differentiate her own view from Nagel's, so she's going to find three different problems. The first problem is the problem that half of the room had last time, and that's when we think about the life that's ended, and we lament the end of those possibilities and the shortchanging of those possibilities. Whose possibilities are they when we're talking about somebody who's actually not there? How do we... She likes the idea that we are thinking about a whole person, a whole trajectory, and we're thinking about an entire life story when we worry about why death is bad for that person. But when we lament the possibilities not able to be realized in someone who's died, we are talking about someone who's actually not here, and we're worried about the evil that befell someone after they no longer existed. And so she recognizes what many of you struggled with last week, which is, how do you lament? How do you say that it is wrong, or that it is a tragic fate that has befallen Joe, when Joe had possibilities until he died, and once he died, he wasn't there anymore to be someone who is absent possibilities. So she gets that this is a problem. She thinks her solution is going to rectify that. Is going to be able to overcome that shortcoming. The second problem she has is related to the asymmetry problem that Lucretius pointed out and Nagel tried to address, and that is
that you care about the existence you don't get coming up in the future, but you don't lament all that time that you never got to meet Heraclitus and all the, you know, and be with Jesus and everything else prior to your life. You only care about what you got ripped off from the point of your death onward. You only care about one half, the existence you didn't get after your death. You didn't get upset, you don't get upset about your prenatal non-existence, and that's an asymmetry problem that she finds to be difficult for Nagel's position, because the possibilities that you worry about are going only in the future. I'm not going to have the possibility of seeing my great-great-grandchild. Yes, but you actually didn't get to meet your great-great-great-great-grandmother, and you're not all that upset about that. Well, she wasn't that nice, but you know. So why do you care in only one direction? Now, Nagel had an answer, so it's not, and Nussbaum doesn't spend a lot of time trying to redeem Nagel because she was trying to differentiate herself. Do you remember what Nagel's answer to that was? Who does he think you would be before you were the egg and the sperm you were? If you weren't that person born plus or minus, let's say, 26 weeks earlier, whatever, you know, whatever number week, what do we say? You could be born 18 weeks early than you were, right? And still be here, maybe. And you could have been born a couple of weeks later than you were, and you'd still be you in that framework. Basically, let's imagine everything went well with your whole, you know, prematurity and all. So basically, though, you only had a couple of weeks leeway to still be you. But if you go back further than conception, and you start thinking about the existence prior to that, who were you before that? If there had been a joining of an egg and a sperm prior to the one that was you, who would that be?
Someone different.
Yeah, it would be someone different. And if you have, if the parents that you had were together at the time when we're talking, that would have been your what?
Brother.
Right, that would have been your sibling. So it's hard for you to get upset about your brother's pre-existence, because it wouldn't be you. Nagel's solving of this problem is that any you before you were you wasn't you. You can't be worried about living with Jesus, because whoever that would have been, it wouldn't have been you, because there weren't the parents that you had at the time of Jesus to produce those egg and sperm that became you. So Nagel seems to be satisfied with his claim that of course it's only unidirectional, because there's you that you could project, the you that's here could project into the future, but you actually can't project yourself into the past any more than plus or minus a few weeks, because the egg and the sperm wouldn't have made you you. And you don't actually spend a lot of time, unless you're very bored and very philosophical, thinking about, well, what if I were a different egg and a sperm? You know, you don't usually spend a lot of time on, what if it hadn't worked out that night and they hadn't gone on that date? Most people don't go there. They just don't care.
I go there.
You do?
People definitely.
And they agonize, and they worry about all that they missed because their parents hadn't gone on that date. My God, if they had just gotten together 2 years earlier, think of all you could have had. If, of course, what? What? Because I got to tell you, you might not know this from biology. The egg that you were, long dead, you know, right? That egg 2 years before, if they had met, that was a dead egg by the time you came around, right? The sperm get 24 hours. And my God, you had a very small window. Okay, that's Nagel's claim, and he's probably pretty convincing. She doesn't want to think he is because she's got to show she's superior. Most people haven't read this 1978 article by the time they get to Therapy of Desire. Nevertheless, whatever. And then her third problem, and this is probably a good claim against Nagel, and it was a strategic decision surely on his part because he's way too smart for this to have, like, escaped him. In the piece that we read, when he's talking about this brain-numbing problem of how do we lament and say that Joe's life went badly for him after he died because who's Joe and all that, all of his examples are people that actually aren't dead in a technical sense. I mean, they're actually alive. Some of them are in PVS. You know, some of them have had catastrophic
injuries, but they're actually all still alive. So he didn't use an example in the piece of someone dead and do a thought experiment around how bad we feel for how bad that person's life is going. We only feel bad for the person who's in an assisted care facility, but we still have a person to care about. So she's probably got a good claim there. If not that it undermines Nagel's argument, then it undermines his, you know, fair play. If he's going to try to convince us of an argument, he should use a dead person that we feel bad for and not a live person who's still there and we can actually attach our concern and sympathy to someone real. All right. Now Williams comes in with I don't know, did you have this piece? Because it's not in my folder. Did I give you the one where Williams talks about categorical desires?
Yeah.
All right. So the categorical desires are what kind of things? Because let me remind us where we are in this argument. Nussbaum is saying to herself, Lucretius is wrong. Why is he wrong? Nagel's got some good possibilities. He gets us down a certain kind of road, but the road dead ends. Williams has a different suggestion. Categorical desires. It's the thwarting of the categorical desires that are the reason why we legitimately fear death. That's her next candidate before she says, I'm actually the hero. But first we go with Williams. And what is her argument? How does Williams talk about categorical desires first, and then we'll ask, why does she think they fall short?
Well, these are desires that we have for themselves, not as a means to achieve something else.
All right. But why are they so important in this context? What is it about life and our fear of death that relates to the categorical desires?
Your categorical desires could occur after you're dead, and that they don't really relate to whether you are alive.
Okay, it's certainly the case that they're not contingent on something. Is that what you mean? That I think we should name some, and then we can think more theoretically about them. Let's get some categorical desires out on the table. What's the criterion we would use to know if we had a categorical desire? What's the definition of them? Those are the desires that what? When you assess your life. No? Why is Williams talking about categorical desires? Whether you've read the Williams piece or her rendition, either way, you can glean very easily what she's talking about, what Williams is talking about. What is a categorical desire? It is so important to your life that it would end of summer, everyone tired. It would keep you from killing yourself. It's the kind of thing so important in your own life, individual life, that because it's being fulfilled, because you have it, you aren't actually going to kill yourself. It's that important. So what kind of things are that big for you? It's the motivation to keep on living. It's the categorical elements that keep you on the planet, without which you would maybe be in danger. But you certainly aren't going to kill yourself so long as what? Like what?
Kids.
Yes, so long as you are raising children and you have a desire to see them grow up, you aren't going to kill yourself. I'm not saying every parent has that categorical desire, but I'm saying if you have the desire to see your children grow up, you are absolutely not going to kill yourself. If that's a categorical desire to you. What else?
Is it religion also?
Maybe. If you are devoted to a certain view of life, that means that you are here on earth for a certain purpose, and that's religious base. Maybe there's other ways to make religion a categorical desire. I don't know. What else?
Being able to, like, walk or...
So what you're saying is, I got up today and I am able to walk. So despite the fact that I'm very, very depressed, I am not going to kill myself because I can walk.
I'm thinking more of someone that's in like a catastrophic accident and then becomes so depressed because they can't.
But then you don't have a categorical desire. I want you to give me the ones that are keeping people alive. Are you trying to give me one that in the absence of which?
Oh, if somebody gets in a horrible accident and they're football player gets paralyzed, and their will to live is to walk again. That could become a categorical desire.
Oh, I see.
After
yes.
that traumatic
yes.
death.
To be
yes. yes, yes, definitely. Okay. What else?
See the Cubs win the World Series.
Right, exactly. You're training to be a practitioner of some sort, a nurse, a doctor, a nurse practitioner. And that is what you absolutely want. And you want it so much, you wouldn't kill yourself because you're achieving this, and that's what you need to do with your life, and that's what you want to do. It's that important to you. Or you are in a certain relationship, and that relationship is so meaningful and important that you wouldn't kill yourself because the desire to be in that relationship is categorical. Or you have a certain work that you're doing that you find to be a calling or a vocation or a mission. And despite the fact that everything else has gone to hell, the fact that you are doing this and then put the this in means that you wouldn't kill yourself because what you're doing is just too important for what you care about. Those are the categorical desires. Right, exactly. That's what he thinks. Now, one of the things that Lucretia, that Nussbaum thinks is that... there may be categorical desires, things that important, that they would prevent you from killing yourself. They are the anchor that keeps you here, even in tough situations. But one of the things she wants to know is, does something have to be so important that it keeps you from killing yourself to be meaningful in human life?
No.
In other words, is human life just made up of a couple of categorical desires? And if so, what about all the rest of it? So what kind of activities, projects, plans, interests, things you enjoy are very meaningful to you, but hell, it's not like you're staying on the planet for them. It's not like if all those other things we just talked about all went away, you had some catastrophic life event and you were no longer able to, you no longer had all the relationships that matter to you, or some devastating situation, or I don't know what. Not those things. But are there other things that aren't that wouldn't keep you from killing yourself, that seem short of that kind of catastrophe to actually be kind of important to you? Because Nussbaum's worried that if the only reason why death is bad is because we are losing our categorical desires, we have then only a narrow set of things that human life cares about. Because there can't be all that many things that's keeping you from killing yourself. I mean, so if they're categorical, they've got to be fairly special and in a fairly unique category. So tell me about the projects and plans and things you care about, things that make life meaningful, that you could still kill yourself, even if you had, and yet they're meaningful.
Isn't it kind of just like the everyday things, like everyday interactions, and
okay,
and the things that wouldn't individually keep you here, but that
as a
all together sort of create the richness of human
life. Yeah. So, like, give me two or three.
I don't know, your pet or your
yeah, exactly. Like, you might very much enjoy your pet, but if all else went to hell, you're not going to stay alive for your pet. You're just going to get your pet to another home, right? Right, exactly. Okay, pets, certain casual friendships, but that are very pleasant, like the collegial relationships that you have. Like, for example, fabulous teachers. I mean, am I seriously going to keep you here if all goes to hell? I doubt it. And yet my guess is you probably liked the class at least well enough not to drop it. It's probably something that felt like a reasonable thing to be doing on a Tuesday night, those of you who are here. I mean, so, but it's not going to keep you here. And yet, it's probably a certain level of import, certainly, you know, $5,000 of import, right? So, but it's not going to keep you here. And yet, probably meaningful enough to put the money out. All right, what else?
Vacations.
Hobbies.
Vacations, hobbies, good. Good.
Desserts.
Who?
Desserts.
I was going to say coffee.
What is it, coffee?
No, but also like jobs that
right.
don't necessarily...
Right, jobs that don't really rise to the Mother Teresa, I'm there every day as a calling to save the AIDS babies, right? Exactly, I mean, most of us want work that's meaningful, but
many of us don't get our work to rise to the level that we feel like, you know, it's so important to humanity itself that without me, you know, right, exactly. So it's meaningful to me, but categorical at the level of seeing my kids grow up. I mean, hey, it's just a job, right? I mean, in a way. Most of us, I think, or a lot of us feel that way. Not that that doesn't make it meaningful, because it is. All right, what else?
Sometimes it worries me that there is no a biological input in this philosophy, like the survival of the fittest, like you as a living system try to survive no matter what.
It's true that philosophers do think that conscious human action drives human life, and not that we're blown, you know, and they do reflect on psychological parts of human life, but they don't tend to do much with biological. I mean, for one thing, because that drive to life can't be all that good, or we wouldn't have suicide, or we wouldn't have people who are like, okay, can I finally die? I mean, you know, there's problems with the biological. We think, if you haven't seen an interesting, you know, critique of the social construction of biology, or how biology is actually not the objective thing we think it is, you know, you can tend to think that it's more powerful motivator, but you're right, she certainly does not have it in her claim. All right, so anyway, what Nussbaum's worried about here is that even if there are categorical desires, if you think about your life ending soon, are the only things that are going to feel like losses to you about the time you're not getting, or things that you would put in a category of categorical desires? And probably not, right? There are so many things that would be of loss to you. And having them is probably not enough to keep you on the planet if some other things go away, which doesn't mean they're not true losses. Devastating losses if you thought your time was short. So Nussbaum finds that Williams has started us down a good path, but she doesn't think that it's really nailing the answer. And so finally, and philosophers are so famous for this, they wait. Back to my colleague Lance is just reading a paper that's coming into academic medicine this fall that I've written. And he was reading it, and he was saying, like, there were about 10 moments when he thought I was going to deliver the punchline. It's the colloquium that I gave in December, if you were there for it, on the sauna standard and the woman in the burger or whatever. And he's like, he was just gearing up, and he thought, now's the punchline. But no, I had to set some more ground. And now's the punchline. No, set some more ground. Yes, indeed, that is the philosophical style, because we are on page 207 when we finally get Nussbaum. That's way more than I did in that piece. She starts the thing on page 192, so we are a good 15 pages in before we get a punchline, but we finally do. So I am going to read what it is. So I am on 207, and we finally get the insight from Nussbaum. I am in the second full paragraph. Four lines in. Death is bad for the person who is no longer, because it makes empty and vain the plans, hopes, and desires that this person actually had during life. Another thinker, Furley, uses the example of a person who plans for his future life in ignorance of the fact that he is soon to die. To the relatives and friends who know this, his hopes and projects for the future seem right now particularly vain, futile and pathetic, since they're doomed to incompleteness. So think about somebody, for example, that is getting all geared up to start medical school, doesn't know that he has a brain tumor, that he only has 2 or 3 months left to live, and so is about to start this arduous training for this goal of doing a profession he very much wants, but won't get through the first semester. He won't even see a patient before he dies. So think about, I think this is the kind of thing we're trying to, that's just one example, but that's the idea of why it feels vain and futile and even pathetic. Furley then argues that removing the knowing relative does not alter the case. In other words, now imagine nobody knows. It's not that everybody was told this behind the, you know, behind the young person's back. It's that nobody knows. But there he is, or she is, getting ready for medical school and getting engaged in, you know, study guides and everything, and the white coat ceremony and everything, and it's never going to come to fruition. And what do we think about this in even in retrospect? Any death that frustrates hopes and plans is bad for the life it terminates, because it reflects, that death reflects retrospectively on that life, showing its hopes and projects to have been at the very time the agent was forming them empty and meaningless. So at the very moment of the MCAT, at taking of the MCATs, it was never going to come to fruition. And when we reflect back on how hard that person worked for the MCATs and the interviews and the applications, all to not get into medical school, but ultimately to get out of medical school, that's the whole point of it, you don't go for the fun of it, we reflect reflectively back and say, oh my God, there was so much work and it didn't come to anything. That's the idea here. The very empty and meaningless. Our interest in not dying is an interest in the meaning and integrity of our current projects, giving the projects we're engaged in right now meaning, fruition, fulfillment. Our fear of death is a fear that right now our hopes and projects are vain and empty. You want to get in?
Yeah, I have trouble with that. Vain, empty, futile, meaningless. Doesn't really sound like tragic, which is what most people would say if a medical student fell over dead in the middle of their first semester.
Well, I think that might be a misunderstanding of what Nussbaum's saying. She's saying she's going to have two categories ultimately. Terrible, and that's for the elderly, and tragic for the young. And now what she wants to do is understand what is it that it doesn't, not what makes a distinction here, but what gives us this continuum between terrible and tragic. And what she's arguing is that that projects and plans are empty and vain. It's more tragic if the project is going to medical school rather than retiring and being able to use your retirement savings. So that she understands there's the distinction. She's not saying that tragic isn't the overarching thing for the medical student. It's that what is it that makes it so bad, of whatever level of bad?
Mm-hmm. But the problem I have with this is that I think it mischaracterizes our intuition about it. Because if I heard about a young med student in that situation dying from this brain tumor, I wouldn't think it was more tragic because of all the work he had put or she had put into their med school, their medical career. I would think it was equally as tragic if it was, you know, someone who was working in a more menial job, you know, who, you know, I don't think that the work that, I think that, like, the judgment in life is less outcome-based than that. And I think that, like, we would think that it was, you know, great that he was going into medical school and all that work wouldn't be futile, though, because it was sort of part of the process.
Well, there's two points you're making, yeah. And they're very different points.
Yeah.
So the one point is, are projects always futile that aren't completed? So that's one question,
right,
that we have to ask about Nussbaum's claim. The other question is, what kinds of projects? I use that example because I thought that I could get it very clear very quickly while I was in the middle of a passage. Because when you're talking about something like education, and you're not doing it education for education's sake. I mean, we had somebody in the program who was 81. He was quite sure that he was not going on for 20 more years of the career that he was in. I mean, he was elderly, and he had some heart problems. And so it was education for education's sake. And if he had been stopped in the middle of it, every class he took felt important to him. So there are types of projects that don't have to be complete to be complete, and don't have to be complete to not be futile. In other words, one of the things we want to do, inspired by Nussbaum, is to ask what does not lose its meaning, even if it's not complete. But your first question was, what kind of projects? Education projects are often not of that first type. Valuable and affirming and important, even if not completed. A lot of times, the only reason you do them is to complete them. I'm going to give you a prime example. Let's forget med school. People usually hate getting a PhD after they've gotten through their coursework.
the coursework is like this. Everybody gets courses, you like them, you're treated pretty well, whatever. And then the slog begins of the rest of the PhD. And that is really just all the time you clog in to get the plumbing license to actually get out and not be a slave anymore. So most people do not enjoy the dissertation stage. No. So if you're not going to complete a PhD, everybody tells you, don't freaking start. Because the thing is, after that, that's called a master's degree. Get a master's, that's fine. But if you're going to get a PhD, you have to complete it. Because all that process is so ugly and nasty, it's not worth it if you don't complete it. So there's two different parts of that. One, that it could be enjoyable in and of itself, just the experience of going through it, even if it doesn't end up getting you the ultimate thing. Then there's other things that you do that are so unfun and you only do them because they're instrumental goods to some other place. Okay, so I use the education of medical school because people often talk about it as in, it's not that fun, so if you don't get out and get to be a doctor, it was not a great thing to do. Maybe that's not true. But here's, what'd you say?
Oh no, I was just gonna say that, well, I see it from two different perspectives. One is that, like, the putting off of your life, putting off of people that you care about or whatever for the pursuit of the education, if I died today, not having finished my degree programs, it would be upsetting to me, not because I hadn't finished it, but because I had put off things that I
Okay, so there's a lot. I want to get to that point. I just want to circle back and say one other thing about which projects, and then we can engage all of these things, these questions. What I want to say, though, was I only picked an education project because a lot of people think that if you don't complete it, there's something that you lost by not completing it. Either because you didn't, you forgone. Or because it wasn't that pleasant. But there's other projects that make life tragic or terrible to be cut off at whatever time it's cut off. And we want to think very expansively about what she means by projects, plans, activities. I use one that was very concrete. What she wants us to do is think about what are all of the various projects that we are engaged in that would make our death tragic or terrible if it were cut off. What are those projects? And we want to be thinking about them because, of course, it's not just people in an education project or people in certain kinds of professions. She means this absolutely universally. So what we want to do is think about, well, what are the projects I'm engaged in right now that if I don't have a certain amount of time to get to a certain distance, lose their meaning, and which ones, even if I don't get a certain amount of time, do not lose their meaning. Because in some ways, her view is fairly narrow. It could be the case, for example, that there are projects we're engaged in right now that if we died on the way home, we could still say it was not in vain that Autumn was working on that project. Some, though, probably are in vain. For example, we're working on a paper. If it doesn't get done and I die, all the work I put in on it, unless it's published posthumously, was in vain because it's just sitting there in notes and nobody can make heads or tails out of it. On the other hand, the fact that I taught this class, if anybody enjoyed it, if I went home and I died tonight, well, even if we weren't at the end of the semester, you might still say, well, but all the classes I had were valuable. It didn't mean that nothing I did in this classroom meant anything because I'm not here to teach the next one, right?
But I'm still struggling with the idea of a life that is constructed through projects.
But I think you may be too narrow in project. Projects, relationships, plans, hopes, activities. What else is there?
Thinking of it that way is very outcome-based as opposed to...
But give me one that isn't.
Like, I think that you could have a different view, that you could look at life in a different way.
But like, give me an example of what...
Okay, so like... For somebody just going off of the med school thing, because you fleshed out the example, you could say that that person, even if they died prematurely in pursuit of their medical degree, that they were, you know, living up to their intellectual potential. They were like pushing themselves, and that is what the ultimate like judge of character is, as opposed to what they complete or don't complete.
Definitely. So one of the projects, though, you can still frame it in terms of projects. The project is to live life with a certain kind of character and to live life exemplifying certain types of virtues. And that would be the kind of project that Nussbaum may be wrong needs a certain amount of extended time to actually be valuable. In other words, if what I want for my life is to be somebody that people said, Autumn is honorable, how much time do I actually need to be honorable if everybody already thinks I'm honorable? I might have actually secured living a life honorably every day I'm living my life. So whether I lived 45 years or 50 years, I could still be said to have lived just as honorably. And so maybe Nussbaum is wrong that time being extended is necessary for every one of the things that is important about my life, because maybe what I'm committed to is a life of a certain type of character, of certain type of virtue, and I don't need, that's my project though. It can still be called a project, it's just that Nussbaum's wrong about it. Nussbaum's wrong that you need a whole lot of time for it, or that you need 80 years for it, because you could be living with integrity or courage or intellectual curiosity without the extension of that kind of time. And it wouldn't make all the moments I was intellectually curious, all the moments I was honorable, all the moments I displayed integrity, it would not make them in vain or empty. So Nussbaum probably has this problem wrong. And that's what I meant by, is it really the case? You haven't shown that these aren't projects. You've just argued they're not futile just because they don't have a certain amount of extension in time, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Can you just clarify for me, for Nagel, number one there, that she her first critique, where are the possibilities? Is the difference between that and what we're talking about now, because Nagel was talking about all the future projects and plans and things that you could do that really die with you, as opposed to Nussbaum saying the current, you know, projects and plans that you're working on now that are lost because you died during the projects? Is that because it seems like she's saying a similar thing to what she's critiquing?
No, think, I know it does. Think about it like this. If I died today, I would never, this is a true story, I would never have been to France. I've been to Germany 20 times, but you know, so don't feel sorry for me. But I've never been to France. I've never seen the Eiffel Tower. That's a possibility I will not have if I die today. Yeah, but guess what? You know, I don't like the French. Right, so who cares? So it's not one of my projects. So what she was worried about with Nagel was that it wasn't mine.
Right.
There's a million things that we don't get to do. Right. I mean, even if you die at 100, there were things you didn't get to do. My in-laws are quite elderly, and they've never been to Europe. But they're still quite elderly, and it's a lot better to be elderly than to die when you're in your youth or in your childhood. And yet, there are things that weren't possible for them.
So really, it's future versus present.
No, it's really about what is meaningful to you, and what you, for Nussbaum, what matters is what are you engaging in? What are the projects of your life versus all the infinite possibilities?
The unique,
meaningful, meaning-laden projects of your life. So if, for example, some of you have never published an article. And those of you who are out there who have never published an article and don't give a rat's ass about publishing an article, it doesn't matter. It's not one of your projects. Whereas if I'm saying this is an article I want to publish, being cut off now and not finishing it may qualify as the kind of futile because I didn't complete it. On the other hand, you're going to quickly object, and I'm going to just give it to you so we can move on, but you're going to object, but what if the writing of it was so meaningful to me that even though it's not quite complete, it still was something that wasn't in vain for me? That'll be okay, as long as the reason that I was writing it really wasn't for the experience of writing it and the enjoyment of writing it. If I was writing it to change the practice of you all in the clinic and you never got to read it because I never got to write it, then in fact, Nussbaum would have been right about that particular project. So you can see how the very same act of writing an article could be qualified as what makes life sad, what makes my death sad if it ends now, and could also be something that doesn't at all make my life sad because it ended now, because in fact I got what I wanted out of it at the very moment. So for example, if writing for you is catharsis, and every moment you write, you feel more at peace, or you feel like you've said, you've clarified something for yourself, or you've exercised some part of your mental faculties that feels like you're really stretching, and if that's what you did it for, that kind of intrinsic, non, to use Emily's word, non-outcome-based result, then it won't qualify
in the same way as constitutive of what made it tragic that my life ended tonight. Whereas, you know, arguing that we should end ethics committees as we know them, I really want to get that piece out there so I can actually end ethics committees as we know it. If I don't get that out there and ethics committees don't end, then in fact it reflects back on me and says, you know, there was some project I really wanted to do and I didn't get to do it. Alrighty. What else here? Give me some other examples of where you think Nussbaum has it right and where you think she might not.
Mm-hmm. You really love sailing, so you're trying to build a boat, but you hate carpentry, and mm-hmm. so you're not getting any enjoyment or any redemption
right.
out of the carpentry process.
Right.
And if you die before it's done, then you can get sail.
Right. I mean, and it's a perfect second example to my medical school or PhD one, because it's, we can actually get a generic or get a universal principle going here for what the distinction is. If there's something that is intrinsically valuable to you in and of itself, in the moment, in the flow of it, that's that word that people often use, if that's what it's about for you, at least significantly enough that it's meaningful, then it probably doesn't qualify as being vain or empty if it gets thwarted tonight, because you had all those moments of it. Yoga practice is supposed to be like that. You're not doing it so that you can put your legs out and your chest on the floor someday. You're doing it for what you get in that actual moment. So it would be strange to say, well, she only got 400 yoga practices in. You know, I mean, that doesn't make any sense, because it's an intrinsically valuable activity in the moment, or you don't know what you're doing. You know, it's not Pilates, for heaven's sake, or whatever. or whatever. But if there's something that is truly only instrumentally valuable for you, but the goal is a good one for you, is meaningful to you, but what you're doing right now is an instrumental activity to some future goal, then, all right. Other questions before we go on to her, to Nussbaum's immortality? I want to get to that and then what her...
What I have problem understanding is like what is important to me now, if I die after the class, once that I'm dead, whatever it was important to me, other people are going to judge it. And I am not sure if they consider that it was important the way that it was important to me.
Well, it's true that sometimes people won't understand the kind of activity that somebody put their life energy into, and that's a different kind of question, but because it's a misunderstanding of what made life valuable for you. Nussbaum's not engaging in that question. It's an important one. What she's engaging instead is the activity that you were engaged in, if we were to understand what it is that was important to you, just by your own lights, did your death make the projects you are currently engaged in vain and meaningless because they didn't come to fruition? Or is she wrong, in certain aspects at least, that they didn't undermine the integrity and value of what you were doing, because in fact everything you were trying to, or a lot of what you were trying to get out of those projects, you actually had in the very moment you were doing them. And I often think that about parenting. She uses parenting as an example. And it makes it sound as in it's vain and futile if you don't get to the end. I'm not sure what the end is, because it seems to me that as the kids keep living, they keep needing parenting, or at least you start babysitting their kids or whatever. I mean, I don't know. But it seems to me that parenting may not quite fit, because it's not a project like, well, okay, the sailboat's done. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, maybe there are milestones, but and there surely are, and I would imagine that graduating from high school is one, or graduating from college, or getting married or partnered, you know, having a baby. And I can imagine that those are milestones that parents want to get to. But does that mean that all the other years in between were vain and empty and futile? That seems very hard to believe. Certainly it seems like what my daughter and son would say, my God, I don't know why she was a mother at all. I mean, she's dead now and I only got her for 10 years, so it was like I shouldn't have had her at all. Really? It doesn't make any sense. I don't know what Martha and her relationship to her daughter is, but it seems a little odd, I have to say, that thing.
Well, we see it frequently in patients who are dying, and you know, they'll say, well, I really, you know, would love to be able to see my daughter get married in 6 months.
Well, I get that, yeah.
But no, what I was gonna say was the same thing as you. If they don't make it to 6 months and they don't see their their child get married, their entire life of parenting and spending time was not in vain because they didn't get to that point.
But that's different than saying, this is something I really want. You know, this is a desire. That would be like, I want to achieve. That would be more of the Williams categorical desire. I want to see this particular milestone. Is Williamsian, not Nussbaumian.
No, I'm disagreeing with Nussbaum.
I agree. Yeah. Nussbaum is basically saying that it all falls apart and goes to hell, but actually it doesn't.
No.
So it is sad for me that I didn't get that. That's true. But it doesn't. It's not sad because it was in vain, or because it was futile, or because it had no integrity. I think in that, she doesn't have it quite right. Now I want to turn to this question of immortality as we wrap up, and I want to make sure we get out of here on time. Williams has, this in this Macropolis case, this thought experiment comes from a novel where someone is immortal because she keeps getting to drink some potion. At 342 years of age, she's so bored, she can't stand it, she just doesn't take the potion, and so of course she dies. Williams' summary then, and his conclusion is that at a certain point you've kind of done it all, you know, been there, done that. And so life doesn't have meaning because you exhaust all the things that are interesting and you just get bored. Of course, Nussbaum does not think that that's it, and so what we want to do is think about what is it. Now, Nussbaum points out a couple of things. First of all, she's 342, but she's the only one who gets to be immortal. So everybody she loves keeps dying their natural lifespan, and she does not. They keep getting sick and dying on her. She's alone. Second, she wasn't groomed to have immortality, and we're going to go through this thought experiment in the next 5 minutes. What does it mean to live a life knowing, and I don't mean an afterlife, because that's a mortal life followed by an immortal life, and the thing about heaven is, when people think about it, especially in the Christian tradition, it's reuniting of all your former friends and loved ones and everything. So it's not like, well, you're alone, you know, swimming up there in the clouds. It's actually that you get to see everybody again and all the past and everything like that. So I don't want us to think about heaven there. I want us to think about being on this earth and what would it be like if we were immortal and we knew we were going to be immortal right from the beginning. Because she wants to end by saying this, so let's give it the punchline first. It's not only the case that it is right to fear death, the very fact that we fear death is what makes life meaningful. The fact that death is bad, it's either terrible and sad or it's tragic, because it depends on what part of the life course this happens to us at. Either way, she says, the fact of our looming death, either in our at some point across the life course, is the very thing that makes life meaningful and the life we have. So we not only should not rail against our fear of death, we should appreciate it for what it actually does to be life-enhancing. So while she entertains the four concerns that Lucretius lays out about how fear of death can paralyze people, and she doesn't want you paralyzed, she does want to acknowledge that life, that human life, is lived better because human life is mortal. And that's where we're going to end. So let's think about that. And why is that true? Why is it true that if we didn't have mortality, we would not have human life as we know it? What does mortality give us?
Sense of urgency.
Okay, so one thing it does is have us have to actually get stuff going, these projects and plans. Okay, if you think about like something that is finite of any sort, how much more do you value something finite than something infinite? If there is something, if you're at a cruise and there's just food and buffet and buffet and buffet, it's not really, you know, you might be liking the food, but it's a different kind of appreciation than when you have a small portion in a fancy restaurant and, you know, it's plated and all this. The idea that it's finite time makes the time more valuable. Because once you have surplus, more than you could ever have, it's not that you wouldn't enjoy it, it's that you couldn't value it at the same level. Okay?
Focuses us also.
Okay, good.
Otherwise you have to like Groundhog Day.
Right, exactly. You just, give us an example. Why does that movie work for you?
Well, just because, I mean, he starts to do a lot of irrelevant and stupid things just because he can do them knowing that will be another day to try it again.
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, if you don't think that time can be wasted, that lives can be wasted, then, and a lot of people don't, because sometimes, I guess people haven't gotten the message, that life is short. And that's probably the case that when you're not engaged in meaningful activity, sometimes life can feel very, very, very long. And so in those kind of cases, you're not actually thinking, well, now how do I make the most of the time that I've got? And as you get more exposure to people who are dying, or as you yourself have an illness, or you have lost loved ones, I think that reality probably becomes more clear. So children probably don't have it, unless they've had some tragic, you know, life experience. They're not thinking, hey, life is short. But the more you see the spring turn into the summer, turn into the fall, turn into the winter, turn into the spring, you know, you see life going, or you see children grow, or whatever the life experience is, suddenly you think, life is short. Now, what am I going to do with it? And I think you're right, focus is one of the things. Shauna?
Yeah, very much related, trying to avoid regret.
Okay.
Culturally, we think about, like, if you're lucky enough to have a deathbed moment and you can think about your life, you're not senile, you know, you want to not regret a lot of terrible things. And I think that in terms of the life lived better, that might sort of tell us to do the best we can in order to avoid that.
All right. I mean, this is the point in the article where she brings in those frivolous, trivial gods, where they don't have to worry about mistakes and bad decisions and hurting others or hurting themselves or, you know, damaging their bodies. So they don't actually have to do a whole lot of prudential thought or the examined life. They can't do the examined life. Because when you have all of it to live, there's no reason to have to make those kind of distinctions about what is the good life. The good life, in fact, this is going to be one of her punchlines, the good life only makes sense when it's mortal. And what she means by good life isn't just a life of meaning, and she does mean that. She thinks the gods have no meaningful pursuits at all. They spend their time just trivial, flighty, you know, worthless pursuits, whereas human beings have to dig down and figure out, well, what is this life I've been given going to amount to? What do I stand for? What am I going to do with my life? But it's also the good life, the life of morality, like Emily was saying, the life of character, the life of virtue. What is her argument here? Or tell me why she would say, without mortality, you don't have morality. Why would that be true? If you don't have, know that death is coming, you can't have morality. Human life requires morality, mortality to have morality.
Because without time constraints, you have no reason to develop a sense of what is right or wrong. You can simply do.
Well, let's think about the two types of things that might be considered the set of virtues. The one are the self regarding virtues, the virtues of, for example, tenacity, or the virtue of reliability, or, you know, self-reliance, or self-examination. None of those things would make any sense if you had all the time in the world, if you had infinite time. Why would tenacity matter? Why would you have to work hard working? You wouldn't need any of that. Other regarding virtues, what we think about our moral duties to others, only make sense in the context of finitude and vulnerability. That is, without human fragility, you don't need morality. If, for example, you could not be killed, you could not be hurt, then why would I have to have any obligations to protect you, protect your psychological well-being, to protect your physical well-being? Why couldn't I try to pinch you and hurt you and assault you or insult you? It wouldn't matter, because your invincibility, your invulnerability would make me not need to behave that way. I'd just be in goody two-shoes or whatever. Why would the purpose be? Morality requires human fragility and vulnerability. So the death that we have, the fact that our life can end suddenly, but ultimately will end regardless, that has morality at play. You can't have character and virtue if you don't have human finitude, because you don't have the vulnerability that actually makes it work. What about relationships? Let's think about that for a minute or two. What would it be like to have partnerships, friendships, marriages in a backdrop of no more immortality? Immortality, what would relationships look like? And why?
They'd be very boring, because immortality would mean also immutability, which means nothing ever changes the personality.
Yes. Right. So, I mean, if on the one hand, you get the whole
Nicodian moment there when you think about any of the central relationships of your life. Whether it's a love relationship, a parental-child relationship, a friendship, the thing that makes it valuable is that you can't hold on to it. Even if you hold on to it for a duration of 50, 60, 80 years, if you're very, very lucky and you do, you still have only held on to it for just 50, 60, 80 years. The thing about this relationship, whichever one it is it is going to end. And the fact that it's going to end means that you can't screw it up. And you do screw it up, but you can't think, well, it doesn't matter, you know, I'll catch up with you in the next, you know, century or whatever. You have to have a kind of attentiveness, a kind of concern. And also, what makes it interesting is that you're going to grow and it's going to develop, and that's the same poignancy, because you know that with every change is a kind of loss and a kind of development, but it's also an investment that means that it's not just stagnant and same old, same old. And while that loss is the sad part of relationships, it's also the thing that makes them profound. At least that's her argument. That without that kind of threat, that the ever-present threat of loss is what makes our valuing at all. Not that we don't get into the realm of tragic sometimes with that, because we do. But regardless of whatever duration, there still is this idea that time is marching on, and you cannot get it back. And if you can get it back, because there's infinite time in front of you, then you don't have that same attitude towards all of those relationships. Okay, so we're going to end it with her thought that there are two really good consequences that come from mortality, as hard as it is and as threatening and scary as it is. And that is that it makes us value the time we have, which we've said, but it also pushes us to immortality. It pushes us to think about how do we as finite creatures achieve immortality. And let's just hear some of those. We started the class off with that Heraclitian thought here, which is that the mortals are immortal. How do you get that? Because she thinks it's one of the best parts of human life that we know that we're mortal, so we try to reach for something that is positively immortal.
Your life lives on through others.
Okay, so one thing, and sometimes very literally genetically, sometimes it's through children that were adopted, and sometimes it's just relationships that you invested in that have so much you in them that the world couldn't, that person, those people that you're touched, couldn't have been the same without your impact on them. And then they have their impact on others, and in that sense, okay? What else?
Works of art.
Works of art, a classic for it, exactly.
Ideas you created.
What? Any
ideas you created.
Ideas, right. Whether they are ideas that you shared in verbal form, in written form, that you shared as oral storytelling. Mm-hmm. What else?
Mm-hmm. Like the wisdom you pass on.
Right. Insights that you had, that you gave to others, key moments, anecdotes, memories that were important or made an impact. Mm-hmm.
You might want to give money to something so they put your name on it.
All right. Okay. So philanthropy itself is a kind of living on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Population control. If we don't have that finite moment or we're going to die, how can we?
I see, you want to give us another good consequence. You want to say that if we didn't die, we would so overpopulate that we'd all starve to death. It's like the deer population in Princeton. Okay, that's true, but it doesn't help us with the immortality. It's true. Any last thoughts on the how we achieve immortality?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking about immortality also, my atoms. I am made of atoms. Well, my atoms are immortal.
Oh, right. Well, that is true. I mean, that's like to dust and more things grow or whatever. Like, yeah, okay, right, exactly. Any others?
Contributions to institutions.
Okay. Okay, but they could also be contributions that are not monetary. You could have, for example, changed a policy. You could have shaped the way that an organization is run, or you could have shaped the way some practice took place. Alrighty, well, there you go. That's, you know, all the answers you need. And so...
It was a great semester, and sorry that it's over, but that's the whole point, exactly. All righty. Send your papers into...